To you, my friend Brooklyn Ballinger. Brooklyn is, I would say, if like in my world, this is like in my age, this is a recent graduate of Newark High School, 2020. She graduated in the midst of a pandemic. You can have that there. She is a ministry student at Mount Vernon Nazarene University. She is studying, I've forgotten, youth and family ministry. And so at a concert, I encountered you at a Newark High School music concert, the choir concert, and we were talking, like, how's the ministry going? She's now got a position at Grove City Church of the Nazarene, right, as an intern there. Is her mic on, guys? I might need to see if the mute is muted back here. Let me see here. Okay, she's on here, guys. So we were talking. I was like, how's it going? She's like, it's going great. I was like, do you get an opportunity to preach? She's like, well, not very often. I was like, do you want to? And she's like, kind of, yeah. And I was like, well, we like to give people the opportunity to use their voice to give us a message from God. So I hope you know this by now. One of my greatest privileges is to bring the message to you every other week. No, every week. But my gift to you is to allow you to hear voices that aren't mine, that other people have a word that God has given them. And so I have for you, Brooklyn Ballinger. Also, I wanted to just, like, he's going to hit. Oh, goodness. You upset Anna, Mike.
Oh, no.
We're
it is.
We're all scared. It was in the wrong channel. Okay. Her dad and I are friends, and that's part of it that I was going to say. David's down there. And Jen, his wife, was children's pastor at Newark NAS for a long time, interim to senior pastor there. They both teach at Mount Vernon Nazarene and at OSU Newark, if that's fair. I think I got that right. So anyway, she comes from good stock, y'all. Like, she's got a great family. We love the Ballingers. They worship elsewhere, but that's great. We're all family. So I don't know if I need to say anything else about you. If you would give a warm welcome to Brooklyn Ballinger.
And I'll leave it to you.
Thank you. Well, good morning, everyone. I'm really excited to be here. So as he said, I'm Brooklyn, and I'm about to enter my senior year at MVNU. And when I was a sophomore, I was given a really cool, it was basically the best opportunity in the world at that time, that I got an apartment with all of my best friends from freshman year. So if you haven't been to MVNU, the apartments are like little townhomes, and they have three bedrooms in them, and then like a little living room, a little kitchenette. But it's six girls who have known each other for about 9 months living in a really close proximity to each other. So it was awesome, in theory. And I was really excited to live with everyone, but what maybe I was most excited for, which sounds a little bit lame, was we had a living room. And I was just really excited. I had, my first year was a COVID year, so like I didn't really get to do anything, but I was just excited for this one little taste of freedom, a living room, where I could sit on the couch, I could read for fun if I wanted to. I could do homework there. I could do like movie nights with our whole apartment or have like a TV show that we watched. And my parents were gracious enough to give me an old TV. So we had a TV. It was awesome. And I was just so excited for this. But one thing that I hadn't really planned on and something that I would not have looked forward to if I had known about it was that my roommates who had boyfriends, those boyfriends would basically become my roommates. Now, at Mount Vernon, as a Christian university, there are very strict rules about like when people can be over, like opposite genders. In the apartments, it was like, You couldn't go into their actual rooms. You just had to stay in the living room. They were only allowed from like noon to midnight. And two of my friends had boyfriends, but one was always over. And when I say always, I mean always. If it was any time in between the hours of noon and midnight, you walk in the door, they're sitting on the couch together. And at first, it didn't really bother me. It was fun. We had people over at our apartment all the time. It was awesome. It was like the dream come true. But after a little while, it started to wear on my patience because this living room that I'd been so excited about was not able to be used for the things I wanted it to be used for. And I started to get a little bit frustrated because they were sitting on the couch that was supposed to be all of ours, in front of my TV, using my parents' Hulu account to watch a show all the time, a little kid's show. And I was just so frustrated. And so this story, as I get into it a little bit more, is not one of my finest moments. So I hope you guys don't hold this against me. But in like October, November-ish of that sophomore year, I had my terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. I normally have about one of those a semester, and it's a day where like all the homework assignments are due. I have a million other things to do. And everything is just generally terrible, horrible, no good, and very bad. So college is so fun. It really is. But there's days that it's not. So on this specific terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day, I had like two papers due the next day. I had a huge exam and just no time. And I can't remember if there was specifically anything that day that was wrong, but that evening, it was a Thursday night, I helped to run a young adult women's Bible study at the church I attended with another girl that I go to school with. But that afternoon, she texted me and said that she was sick, she couldn't be there, and she was supposed to lead the devotional. So I had to take time out of my studying, out of my writing my papers, to sit down and write a devotional. And then when I showed up that night to the Bible study, nobody came. And I was just like, you're kidding me. I spent all this time writing this devotional, and it's going to go to waste. Hindsight, it didn't go to waste. I actually got to work on it for a whole week and then shared it the next week. But my very irrational, emotional state at that point could not take it. And so I get in my car, I drive to my apartment's parking lot, and there's no parking spaces. And there are never parking spaces in that parking lot, but it never made it any easier. And so I start circling the lot basically a million times because Mount Vernon's a pretty small campus, but if you really have to walk anywhere, it feels like a big walk. And so I had to like park in the chapel lot, and it was going to be so long of a walk. It felt like it would take like 20 minutes. It's like a 5-minute walk, maybe like 0.2 miles. But it just felt so big. And on top of everything already, I was frustrated. And now I'm not even being dramatic. I could be dramatic, but this is not me being dramatic. As soon as I parked in the chapel parking lot, downpouring. It was the final straw, basically. It was pouring. I searched my car. There's no umbrella. There's no raincoat. So I just had to deal with it. And so I'm basically stomping around in the rain all the way back to my apartment. I open the door, and guess who's sitting on my couch watching Gravity Falls on my TV? My roommates. And I lost it. I start yelling at them, because why were they using my TV, my parents' Hulu account? Why were they in our shared space? And then I stomped up the stairs, slammed my door, and locked myself in there. The next day, I didn't talk to anybody that night. The next day, I told my roommate about it in the early morning, and I just started laughing because that was such a silly thing to lose my cool on. But it was just all the things stacked together that I was bound to to erupt at someone. And I'm not saying that's right, it's just what happened. Because those things on their own wouldn't have made me frustrated, but all those things stacked together just was a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. And so I started to think that I needed to apologize to my friends, but I didn't know how, because what was I to say? Also, I was already so embarrassed by what I did that I didn't want to bring it back up again, because that would be even more embarrassing. Plus, I just truly, like, what would I put in an apology to them? Because I was sorry. I truly, deeply was sorry, because those are my friends. But how was I to recover from this? And so this is a little bit of what I'm going to be talking about today. What does it look like for us to actually apologize, to take those steps and to have those hard and uncomfortable conversations? I was told, as Pastor David said earlier, that you guys have been kind of going over some steps to discipleship, even talking about what it might look like to recognize that you've made mistakes, to be willing to go talk to them. And so this week, I'm talking about what the actual act of going to talk to them might look like, what the practical steps of that might look like. And so as I was thinking about this, I was trying to think of reasons that it's hard to apologize to people. Because especially when they're people that we deeply care about, people that we don't want to have, like, dissonant relationships with, why is it so hard to apologize? And so I took to some psychology articles, looking around at it, and in mostly from Psychology Today, but with a couple other sources together, I found that there are two main reasons why people have a hard time apologizing. The first is that we assume apologizing won't be accepted. We assume that it's not going to give us any forgiveness. And then the second is that it's a threat to our self-image. And as a basis for both of these, apologizing is just uncomfortable. It requires us to bring up times that we messed up. And we have to bring it up with ourselves in order to be willing to apologize. But also we have to bring it up with the person that we're apologizing to. So this is like the root of why these are uncomfortable. But again, leads into the two reasons that I'm going to dig into a little bit deeper right now. So even though, remember, the first one is assuming that the apology will have a negative impact or it won't be accepted. So even though we may care for the person that we wronged deeply, one reason we hold back apologies is because we think it won't be accepted and it won't provide forgiveness. We miscalculate how likely it is that the victim or the person that we harmed will forgive us and how helpful it'll be to restoring that relationship. So why would we dredge up old and uncomfortable things if this apology won't even be accepted? The second is a threat to our self-image. We, as human beings, want to be viewed as good and moral people. So causing harm to others will make us feel shame and guilt. We overestimate the negative implication apologizing might bring. We think it'll affect the way others view us. We also think that it will feel even more humiliating and stressful to apologize. To apologize means to call out your own wrong behavior. And this calls attention to our immoral and negative behaviors. This brings us face to face with the fact that we have something to apologize for. Now, we have to overcome these things. We have to just be uncomfortable to apologize, to make amends with people. And I find that the most helpful way, the first person I want to look to when I need help overcoming uncomfortable situations or when I'm a little bit lost, is Jesus. It's a very Sunday school answer, but it's just the truth. It's the best place to get that kind of advice. And so near the beginning of Jesus' ministry, found in the book of Matthew, he preached the Sermon on the Mount. And this was a time of Jesus looking back at old teachings in the law, but also him sharing what he was trying to bring to us and just making everything more accessible to the world. But the beginning of the sermon starts with the Beatitudes. And these are a series of blessings. And they're blessings that Jesus shares to those who follow him. The action that gains the blessing is typically reflecting the character of God. And the blessings that you are given are furthering the kingdom on earth and also being called children of God. So today we're going to be talking about one of the Beatitudes, Matthew 5, 9. Matthew 5, 9 says, God blesses those who work for peace, for they will be called children of God. Now this term, working for peace, in this verse is not talking about people that live in peace and enjoy the many benefits of living in peace, but people who actively devote themselves to working for peace, for working for reconciliation among individuals, families, and others. One thing that can kind of establish the difference between living in the benefits of peace and actively working towards peace is actually the historical context of when Jesus was speaking this. And I won't go too far into this because I know history can sometimes bore people, but I do love it. But in this time, it was in Rome, it was the time known as the Pax Romana. This is simply translated into the Peace of Rome. This was a time in Rome where their military was superior, and they held off all the other armies so that there was little to no conflict. But the context of peace from the Hebrew understanding is the word shalom. And this word means, or can be understood, as a harmonious cooperation aimed at the welfare for all. This is the peace that Jesus is talking about. It isn't about letting things stay as they are to avoid discomfort or pushing back other militaries and just allowing peace in your country and not anyone else's, but to actively work towards the harmony for the welfare of all people. Jesus is saying that someone that seeks peace when there is division and strife embody what it means to be his children. Now, looking through this lens, does it make sense to avoid apologizing to a brother or sister that we've harmed because it's too uncomfortable? Is that working for peace? Is that working for shalom? Is that working for the harmonious cooperation aimed at the welfare for all? Or is it just keeping peace? Is Jesus telling us to keep the peace or to create peace? So sometimes it takes disrupting things to work towards peace. Because when we think about it, is there really peace between you and someone that you've harmed if you haven't apologized? Even if you aren't having the uncomfortable conversation to apologize, there's still tension in that relationship. There's still something that's longing for reconciliation in that relationship. For us to work for peace is to be children of God. We can't let our uncomfortability, which I don't think is a real word, keep us from mending relationships. So now that we've gone over why we should be working towards reconciliation and the hesitations we need to overcome, what does it look like to apologize? Before we talk about the steps we should take in apologies, we need to know what apologies don't look like. The following statements are frequently misunderstood as apologies, but are most definitely not apologies. I'm sorry you feel that way. I'm sorry you misunderstood what I said. I'm sorry, but it was your fault that I did this. And But what about the time that you did this? These are not apologies. These are defenses. These make us feel better because we said the word sorry, but it doesn't require us to own up to anything that we did. We are putting more blame on the person that we harmed than on ourselves. These apologies are acting from a place of uncomfortableness. These not apologies are just as, if not more, harmful than not apologizing at all. Now, this leads us to the question, what does a sincere apology look like? And now I'm going to take a moment to apologize to all of you guys, because I myself am not a visual learner, and so I don't think to include things for visual learners. So you guys are just going to have to listen to these steps and not see them on the screen. And that is, I am very sorry about that. My apologies. But here are my steps to a real apology. There's three steps, and two of the steps include two things in the steps. So I don't really know about the math, but we're going to say it's three steps. But the first step is to share the what and why. Let the person know what you are apologizing for and why it is wrong. What did you do to harm them or to let them down, and why is that wrong? How do you know that that was a bad thing that you did? Now, the second is responsibility and commitment. Now, you have to take responsibility for what you did. You have to openly accept and declare, even, that you did something wrong. How did this thing you did come to be? And that's a confusing sentence. But did you have a bad day and snap at someone who wasn't really doing anything wrong? Or were you caught up in a moment and while everyone was gossiping, you betrayed someone's trust and shared a secret? Do you have troubles with your anger, self-control, patience, lust, greed, or your self-image? What is it that caused this thing you did to be wrong? And now that you've identified that, commit to working on that thing. Show that you know why you made that mistake and that you will be more aware to not do it again. And now that you've shared that with this person, there's a sense of accountability because you've been vulnerable. You've shared this part of you that's very uncomfortable to share, and now they know about this. And for if they are accepting of your apology, but even if they're not, they know to be aware and to look for these things and so that they can see, hey, you just were gossiping again. You said you were going to work on this. And now you can say, oh, thank you for holding me accountable to that. And you know there's someone else looking out for you in that sense. But I actually was thinking of this example of this accountability and commitment, responsibility and commitment. And it was actually very recent. Last week, I was at a kids' camp for my district. And so there was about 250 kids from all different churches around Columbus, Nazarene churches in Columbus. But I was given the opportunity to lead the prayer station. So over the 4 days, I got to see all these different churches, all these different kids. But one thing that I love about kids is that they're so open and honest. Because especially little ones, they don't know to be ashamed of anything yet. They're just sharing open and vulnerably. And so in that room, there were just beautiful and just heartwarming and heart-wrenching conversations with God just shared everywhere. But one of the last groups that I led, there was a bunch of really little kids in it, but I saw this first grader sitting in the corner looking very confused. So I went over to him and asked if he needed any help. He told me that he couldn't read what the station was and didn't know what to do. And this station was called the Image of God Station. So they sat in this little rocking chair, and they had a bunch of mirrors surrounding them, and they got to just look at themselves and think, am I reflecting the image of God? Am I being like Jesus would be? And so I just talked to him, and I told him to ask himself if he acts like Jesus would act, or if he makes choices like Jesus would make. And this little boy looks at me, scrunched up his little face, and he said, I want to, and I try to, but it's just so hard. I keep messing up. And he just looked so distressed and even disappointed in himself that I wanted to continue that conversation and asked if he knew anything that he could kind of be working on. And what might be keeping him from acting more like Jesus? And he thought for a second, and he said, I think I could have better control of my emotions. And a little heart was just swooning over him. He was so sweet and just had such a genuine reflection of himself and the things that he had done wrong and the things that he needs to work on so that he can further a beautiful relationship with God. And so this first grader took time to recognize these mistakes and what's keeping him from being more like Christ. I think we could all be a little bit more like this first grader. This is what I'm talking about, and the accountability and the commitment. Recognizing that you don't always act like God, or you hurt this person, but then committing and recognizing, I need to have better control of my emotions, and working on that, and even asking God to continue to help you with that too. And so then the last step of this forgiveness, of asking for forgiveness, or of apologizing, sorry, is asking for forgiveness. This last step might be the hardest, because this can set us up for rejection, which is not something we typically like to do. But this last step to an apology is to ask if this person will forgive you. And if you have given a sincere and an open apology, you have created a space that allows for vulnerability. This means that they might be honest with you and tell you that they're not ready to forgive you. But at this point, you've done everything you can. You have taken the hard but brave and uncomfortable step towards reconciling that relationship. But God blesses those who work for peace, for they will be called children of God. Are you guys ready to go work for peace? Are you ready to be called children of God? Are you ready to make the uncomfortable yet peacemaking steps to reconciling relationships? Are you prepared to disrupt things on the way of creating peace? So, as I close today, I pray that you guys are ready to take these steps. I pray that you guys go and create peace in the relationships that need it. Thank you guys for having me. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for this time that we can all gather together. Thank you for open minds and open ears and open hearts that will continue to be shaped by you. In leading those of us that need to go and reconcile relationships, for those of us that need to go take those steps to apologize to those that we've hurt. Help us to be brave. Help us to be vulnerable. Help us to be honest with ourselves and to others. Lord, we just love you, and we desire to be children of God and to look more like you. So help us to be peacemakers, to be those who work for peace. It's in your name we pray. Amen.